starting a session now on servanthood and what does it mean to be servant. It's not a word that is very popular because everybody wants to be leader, lord, higher up. Servant is not attractive to most of us. And I've written about this, and so I just want to have you note the books that I've written. In fact, the one on servanthood at the top is has now reached over 40,000 copies in distribution, and has become a bestseller for the publishing company. And what I'm going to give you now will be just a small sampling of what's in that book. But if you want more, the Servanthood book is available to you. It's also available in Russian, Russian and Chinese and Portuguese and Korean. The conflict material is contained in the book Cross-Cultural Conflict, which is there on the board. The publisher is InterVarsity Press, if that makes any difference. And then the material that we had on cultural differences is contained in the book in the middle, Cross-Cultural Connections. And together, the three of them have sold over 100,000 copies. So they have found some acceptance and helpfulness in the larger community of people who are going internationally or even across ethnic groups. I know a couple of people who have bought it because they're working with their spouse through the book. And that's also kind of pleasant, and I find that very gratifying. So at any rate, those books are available if you should wish to go further in any of these topics. So right now, we're talking about servanthood. What does it mean to serve? Well, when I was involved in teaching, I was teaching about 500 missionaries a year and also some expatriates from multinational corporations in how to adjust cross-culturally. So on any given year, maybe at least 700 people going through my teaching, some others, faculty with me, part of the teaching program. And especially in our missionary community, we found that the frequent word was serve or servant. We want to serve the people. We want to serve the church. We want to serve the culture or the society. We want to serve God. So that was the theme very often throughout the entire program. Eventually, over the years, I got to travel more. And as I traveled in a variety of countries, I would ask the question of certain people, usually church leaders, sometimes people who were on the streets who knew Americans that were there. Sometimes it would be leaders of denominations, and I would ask them this question. What could missionaries do to more effectively minister the gospel of Christ in your country? And so they would often say that they were very grateful for the missionaries who had come, because much of the time their salvation came through the message of missionaries. And so they were very grateful for this. And we're thankful to God for the people who had come, oftentimes from North America, but also from Western Europe and other countries as well. So then, as they finished their very kind remarks, they then said missionaries could be more effective if they didn't think they were so superior to us. And that was that came so many times, slightly different ways, but essentially the same message, that I realized that there had to be some substance behind it, some general reason for it. So I thought to myself, well, I don't think missionaries generally think of themselves as higher. They don't consciously do that. I mean, none of us do, but maybe a few, but most of us don't. So that doesn't seem to be the problem. So what can be the problem? Well, I think one of the problems is that and this would be true of all of us, if we were to go into another culture, we would tend to assume that they're much like us, and so I can be myself, and they will be themselves. And sure, there's clothing differences and food differences, but pretty much were the same. And of course, we already know that there are some very deep differences in how we handle conflict, how we think of shame or face or embarrassment, the cultural differences, the use of time, all of these kinds of things. So just by being who they were, more assertive, task-oriented, get the job done, they tended to come across as being superior. Our way is better, my way is better, your way is not as good. But the other thing that I think happened with missionaries, and actually anybody who goes cross-cultural, because now there are Brazilians going to South Korea, and there are South Koreans going to Congo, and you know, I mean, this is happening all over the place. But what we're finding is everybody makes the same human mistakes. So what I'm saying about Americans is probably going to be true of Koreans or Brazilians or Russians. The other thing that happened is I think that when, at least in America, when we call ourselves servant and we hear ourselves thinking that and saying that frequently, a little switch goes off in our head and we say, ah, now I am a servant. See, if I think I am, it doesn't take much to say I am. Now, if you think you're being servant, then everything you do is assumed to be serving the people, serving the culture, serving the church, etc., serving God. However, unless you're aware of the cultural differences and make those adjustments, you're not going to come across as servant, but you're going to come across consistently as foreigner who wants to do things in the foreign way. And people perceive that as arrogance, pride, high status, or even neocolonialism sometimes, paternalism, like the father or whatever, or maternalism, the mother. And so these people were telling me that the missionaries, yes, they call themselves servant, but that's not how we see it. So that was a little bit hard to handle, but it's good information, and they did it graciously. Now the question is, what does servant look like in your culture? So now over the next, I think it was over a dozen years, as I traveled in dozens of countries, I asked this question, what does servant look like in your culture? And I'll ask you that question. When you see somebody who appears to be serving you, you feel served when they have been around you or done something. What is it that's happening? What does a servant look like in Russian culture? What do you think? And you can refer to your own experiences. When somebody has done something, you say, wow, that person was really good. Maybe you can say that person really served me well. What's happening?
I think, according to my research, most of the people expect leaders and servants to be humble. It's the most common word. Attentive, listening, and then helping people. Really trying to understand people, what they need, and not to push their own agenda, but to help others' agenda. This is a servant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think those are a number of good points. Very good. Thank you. Larissa?
I would also suggest that not only do they accommodate others in many ways, but they do it in a very servant spirit in terms of sacrifice. I mean, one of the, people in Russia are involved, just like in America, in many things daily. They're involved in their daily routines, and it's really hard to put in the schedule anything. But if you feel like someone, if you're feeling depressed or you want to talk or you need help of any kind, if you see that someone is making a sacrifice, or maybe you don't even see it, but then you know it later, then it's one of the major signs that this person cares for you, that he's a true servant.
Mm-hmm. So they're generally giving up something that would be comfortable or easy for them to do something that would be of benefit and bring something to you. Yes, very good.
I would say one very interesting kind of like point of certain sincerity. There's right now, especially when there's elections come, everybody say we're your servants, and while they really struggle for the power, gets to the right place and gets more money. So it seems like, and even like in the capitalism, that says the clerk is smile to you because he makes money out of you. So whatever the things, they're nice to you, they do even because they once finally to get the money. So the sincerity when a person do something that you don't want anything from you. I mean, you wants you, or like when Paul said. So it seems like that more with the capitalism came in and say, okay, nobody before nobody smiled at me. Now they smile for me because they want something money of me. So that's some sincerity with without return that shows. Even they'll forgive you when you do some wrong things. But if you sense this sincerity and you do it, so they might forgive you if you think you even serve them wrong, but that's there'll be more value sometimes with them.
All right, so it's the person who does things or makes sacrifices sincerely for your benefit, not for their own benefit, and so otherwise there would be mixed motives. Exactly. Anyone else want to what are people doing or saying when you're feeling served by them? Any other thoughts? Well, let me introduce my discoveries, and yours certainly fit in there. And as I gathered, I don't know, hundreds of responses, I suppose, they seem to fit into some categories. And so I'm going to show those categories to you. And first of all, I want to talk just about the title, Pilgrimage to Servanthood. When I heard so many people say that arrogance seemed to be the characteristic that was interfering with people doing their job well, doing it in a sensitive way, in a sincere way, that really caused me some frustration. I thought, oh, come on, folks, let's get it right, okay? Let's try to get this better. And so when I came back from some of these trips, I would be speaking to a group and I'd call for a moratorium, a cessation, a stopping of the use of the word servant. Because we're not being servants if people see us as being arrogant or superior or higher than, better than. And so that came forth with a little bit of resentment and anger, and so I'm calling for this stopping of it completely. And then I realized that probably servanthood is a pilgrimage. It takes time to be servant in a new culture. We don't exactly know how to do it, but I then issued a call for people not to call themselves servant until the local people begin to use the word or the concepts of servanthood about them. Then maybe you can say, I think maybe I am being a servant of Christ in this culture, in this community, in this church. So it is a pilgrimage, and it takes time, and it takes a lot of learning. It takes adjustment along the things that we've been talking about so far in these sessions. And it takes daily discipline, daily reflection. How did I do today? Did I do something wrong? Did I offend somebody? Not intentionally, but how do I make it right? What should I have done differently? And so we're constantly making those adjustments. So servanthood is a pilgrimage. It's not a switch that goes off. It's not easily done. And we probably shouldn't call ourselves servant until other people think of us in those terms. Well, the first aspect or the first characteristic of a servant seems to me, according to all of these conversations, the issue of openness. Openness is the ability to welcome people into your presence and to make them feel safe. This issue of safety and security is not so much a physical one, but an emotional one, where you relax physically and emotionally because there's something about these people that they signal that they're happy that you're with them. They're actually delighted that you're there. They're pleased. They count it a privilege to have you there. So this openness is the ability to embrace people and to make them feel safe and to feel secure. And it's in that kind of context that people begin to communicate openly and to share their lives with each other and to begin the bonding process. What often happens is we experience differences. The differences of food or the differences of how people communicate or differences with time or how things are managed. And differences can threaten us. And when they happen to us, we often tighten up inside and we withdraw a little bit, or we make negative attributions, as I said before. Openness is difficult because of some research that I gave you earlier. How long does it take us to determine whether there's a possibility for friendship when we meet somebody? The research says less than 5 seconds. See, so within 5 seconds, either we remain open or we close down. And most of the time, we don't know the person, we think nothing of it, and so we just unconsciously close down. When Jesus met the woman at the well, this was a perfect opportunity for rejection. This woman had been rejected by her own Samaritan community. She had been rejected rather fiercely and intentionally and harshly by virtually all other Jewish men and women. She was accustomed to rejection. And so when Jesus came to the well, she was expecting that he would reject her just like all the other Jewish men had done. Furthermore, Jesus being a Jew and she being a Samaritan, the Jews hated the Samaritan. So not only would he reject her because he was a Jew, but because she was a Samaritan. He would reject her because she was a Samaritan woman. By the way, the Jews believed that the Samaritans were made to fuel the fires of hell. Fairly low view of people, wouldn't you say? They're kindling their wood for the fires of hell. So that was their view of the Samaritan. Jesus knew she was a Samaritan. He knew she was a woman, obviously. He also knew, and by the way, women were low caste people. There was a group of Jews called the bruised and bleeding Jews. They thought that women were the source of all evil and all that is bad in the world. Whatever our problems are, it's because we have women. We have to put up with them in our society. So what happened is that whenever they would see a woman, they'd put their hands over their eyes and they'd go off the path quickly and try to get past them, but they'd trip over the rocks and fall into the thorns, and thus the bruised and bleeding Jews. And of course, they became extinct, which isn't hard to understand. But there were people who had that even extreme view of women. And if you read much of the early literature, you'll see that women were held in pretty low esteem, except when Jesus came. Women were important. Well, now she's a woman, and she's an adulteress. She's had all of these husbands, and she's living with another man yet. And so she's, in the eyes of the Jewish people, a very gross, very severe, very extreme sinner. How does Jesus show openness to her? Do you remember the story? John 14, I think. How does he show openness?
It was interesting, but he asked her to serve him and give him water. So he accepted her help. And now, he started to talk to her. I mean, just nobody talked.
First of all, he talked to her in a gentle voice and asked something of her kindly. But now, if she's going to give him water, she has to touch something, right? Okay. If a good Jew touched a Samaritan, he would have to go to the temple for cleansing because he had been contaminated by this person. And now not only is it the Samaritan that's doing it, but the woman who's this terrible sinner. And he says, are you willing to help me? Can you give me some water? And so he treats her not as a Samaritan, not like the other Jews, but as a human. There's the embrace. And she begins to relax. And she begins to feel comfortable in the presence of this person who is very opposite of who she is. Of course, she doesn't know it's Jesus. But she knows he's a Jew, probably a religious Jew. She knows he's a man. And all of these things now are clouding her mind. And Jesus opens the embrace, the capacity to welcome her into his presence, to make her feel safe. And now she listens and trusts him as the Messiah. Openness. Welcoming others into your presence and helping them to feel safe. The ability to withhold judgment and to wait and give this person the chance, but to accept them as human beings, to make them feel comfortable, welcome, be gracious, value them.
We strive to serve the contemporary Christian community and with a variety of Christian educational and evangelistic resources. To see TVS resource base, please visit tvseminary.com.
Value them. I'm going to give you a couple of stories where I was not open, and then probably in the next session or later on, I'll give you the answer to the stories, okay? You already heard the problem about the Maasai spitting, so you know the answer to that. But you see, what happens is when you know that the spit is a blessing, then you say, oh, now I understand. But at first, the tendency is to reject. Now I can accept. You heard the story about the about Eunice and my suspicion and premature judgments about Eunice. And now, knowing what the passive voice and the active voice mean, and how Eunice was really the very innocent, perfect, you know, well-behaved person in the whole thing, she did everything right. Now, rather than rejection, I can embrace. I can say, oh, I understand. We're so quick to reject. So here's two stories. I came home from work one day. It was winter time, and a fair amount of snow had fallen. I called ahead. I don't like to drive over fresh snow in my driveway because it packs down and gets icy and slippery, and you can slip as you're coming and going from the car. So I called ahead and said to Muriel, tell the boys that when they come home from school today, they must clean off the driveway before I get home. So then we'll have that finished. And sometimes they would have to do the driveway, and sometimes I would clean the snow off myself. But this time it was, I called. So she says, I'll do that. When I got home, it was plenty of time for them to have shoveled off the driveway. But the shovels weren't even out. The driveway was covered with about that much snow, and nothing had been done. And now I have to do it. And I'm upset. Those guys, they are so lazy. How do they think they can get away with this? And all right, this week you won't get your money because that's going to be your punishment. And maybe you're going to have to hear some harsh words from me too as party. You know, so I'm already arranging everything that I'm going to say and everything that I'm going to do. And yet I don't understand why the driveway isn't shoveled. But I've made my decision. I've made my judgment. I know they're lazy. Okay. The other story has to do with a Russian flight on Aeroflot in 1990. And I was sitting in the back of the plane and reading, and all of a sudden a flight attendant was there, and she had a tray of apples. And they were quite small apples, and they looked like they were not very good, maybe even wormy, I don't know. They just didn't, so the apples were quite small and didn't look good. So I smiled and I says, no, thank you. But I'm thinking, how did she know I was American? And I don't know if she did, but she, you know, I assume she did. And why did she offer me the worst apples on the plane? She had apparently served everybody else, and she now serves me the worst apples. And I'm saying, oh, sheesh, you know, I don't want to travel here anymore, you know, those kinds of thoughts. In both situations, I do not remain open. I've made up my mind. I know that somebody has a problem here. But it's not my problem, it's their problem, all right? So you think about that for a while. Of course, it's going to turn out like the Eunice story, the Zulu lady in South Africa, but how does it come about? It turns out like the spittle from the Maasai warrior, but how is it going to come out? So this issue of openness, the ability to welcome people into our presence and to make them feel comfortable, to relax them so that there can be honest conversation, a sense that we're safe with each other, a sense that I'm not going to be judged, I'm not going to be rejected, somebody's not going to speak harshly to me, somebody's not going to be mean to me, that I'm safe with you. You're safe with me. We can build on that foundation. Okay. With each of the characteristics of servanthood, in this case, openness, I'm going to talk about biblical concepts which support this idea of openness, and then also the necessary skill that will help us to be open people, or whatever the characteristic is. So the biblical concept of hospitality is quite an important one. In the very early days, when people came, were traveling, and then they came to the end of the day, someone would see them and they would be invited into the home. And they would be welcomed there as people who were on a journey. They would be treated as family. They would be given nice place to sleep, nice place, nice food to eat. And that was hospitality. So, and when they left, if the people were very hospitable, they would say that we feel so good having been here. It was like a healing place. It was like a place where we're now better off. We feel better going than we were when we came. Thank you for helping us to get better, to feel better. Well, eventually then, the word hospitality became the word hospital, the place where healing takes place. But it wasn't just kind of a social kind of healing, but also now physical healing. Now, in America, we call hospitality when we invite somebody in for an evening. And we maybe have food, or we have some drinks or some snacks or something like that, but that's called hospitality. But hospitality in the biblical sense really goes much farther. It's the embrace of people, the warmth, the welcome, the caring. These are more important than the drinks or the food or the snacks or things like that. Most of us are not really good at the biblical concept of hospitality. I'm not very good at it, okay? My wife is very good. People relax in her presence. People tell her their life story, their deep secrets, in 5 minutes of talking. So I have to follow her example in these things. And then, of course, the biblical concept of shalom. The beginning of each relationship starts with the offering of peace. Peace be to you. The end of the relationship, peace go with you. You see, the shalom of God, but then also the shalom of God that we offer each other. This sense that we are people who embrace, who care, who love, who want peace to be beginning, end, and everything in between. So the biblical concepts of hospitality and shalom tell us about this openness, the way in which we welcome people into our presence, into our homes, into our lives. The primary skill of openness is to suspend judgment. So if I see someone that doesn't look like me, maybe doesn't dress like me, my tendency is to say, that's fine, leave them alone, they do their thing, I do my thing, fine, good. Because I think that there's not much chance that we'll be friends. They're too different from I. Rather than making an attempt, being open at least. If they don't want to be friends, then that can be their choice. but it shouldn't be my choice. So we suspend judgment, and that keeps us open to understanding, open to new relationships, open to build bridges with people who are not the same as we are. And so that is the issue of openness in the biblical concepts and the primary skill that's necessary.
Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will also supply and increase your store of seed and will enlarge the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way so that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 10, 11. How to give to TVS Ministry. You may give online at efca.org/givenow. In the description place, write Russia Distance Learning, account number 24109-0150. Or make checks out to EFCA. Write on the check memo line, Russian Distance Learning, account number 24109-0150. Mail to EFCA Donor Services, 901 East 78th Street, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55420-1300. Or send your gift through PayPal for tvs.gift@gmail.com.